Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. We're going to finish up central nervous system today, move on to peripheral nervous system, and it is October 22nd, Wednesday. All right, so let's take a look at the schedule after I manipulate some of these lights right here. All right, that's working great. So the schedule on the right-hand side says the 22nd, indeed, we're going to get into peripheral nervous system. And the way that we understand the peripheral nervous system or define where it is kind of funny. Why do you think I'm thinking that it's kind of funny, peripheral, as opposed to central nervous system? Central nervous system is really easy to define. How would you define central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord, just like that. But peripheral nervous system, how do we have to define it? Everywhere except the brain and spinal cord. So it's not a whole list of things that I can tell you that are in the peripheral nervous system. It's just not. It's nervous tissue that's not in the central nervous system. All right, so you had a test a week and a half ago. Went over those in lab. Go over practicums today in lab. Next week we're going to start a dissection, namely eyeball dissection. And so I remind everybody in lab what to bring in, and that is gloves, hand protection, and eye protection. And if you want to bring in a mask, that's fine. But there's something that I forgot to mention to one class. If you want to bring in a lab coat, you might want to do that, or a shirt, a lab shirt, just so that if some eyeball juice squirts up on your clothes, it just squirts up on your lab coat that you can take off and throw in your car or throw out after lab as opposed to your regular good clothes. All right, that's the only other thing, but just remember, you do have to bring gloves and protection for your eyes. Sunglasses won't work. And maybe the best thing to do is just go to Smart and Final, Costco, Sam's Club, Harbor Freight, buy a box of gloves so that you have a whole bunch. Or maybe you and your lab partner can split up a box of gloves, and I can store them in lab for you. Right? And I can keep your glasses in lab, too, if you want. That's the cheapest way. Because I think at the bookstore, it's $1 for a pair of gloves, which if you need them, that's great. But if you need 20 pairs, then that gets expensive. You can probably buy like 4 boxes of gloves somewhere else for $20. Okay. So your next test is November 17th. So how many weeks away is that? Well, it's 1, 2, 3.5 weeks. That's going to be on a Monday. Is that right? Yeah, it's going to be on a Monday. And there's no practicum that week, so that the Monday lab group will only have that lecture exam, not a practicum on that day. And those are the chapters, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. Makes me wonder, are there any chapters left? Oh, yeah, you've got a couple chapters left after that. Okay, so I saw some people working with their exam figures and the models in lab already for things that we haven't covered in lecture, and that's great if you're using that study guide now to prepare for this test. Because don't forget, you got to work repetition into your study, but you also need, after you learn something, to sleep so you can integrate it into your long-term memory. So cramming just doesn't work for this class. And the sooner you start studying, the more sleep you get as you're learning, the better off you will be. The more fun these exams will be. Okay, any questions on the schedule or anything like that? No, we're good. And what about SI? Do we have any announcements from SI? No, just good standard operating operations for SI. Okay, I'll put that away. And last time, we were talking about a tract, or different kinds of tracts, how we might want to classify tracts. And if I were to say tracts in the central nervous system, would that be redundant? Because where do you find tracts? Only in the central nervous system. So if I say tract, I certainly don't have to tell you that it's in the central nervous system because you know that already. All right. So here we see three different classes of tracts, and we said that radiation fibers, tracts take information from superior to inferior parts of the central nervous system or inferior to superior. right? It could go either direction. That's a projection fiber. And as a matter of fact, if it goes from inferior to a superior part, how would we want to classify that tract by function? By function, what kind of tract would that be? And you have two choices. You could say efferent or afferent. Okay, so let's figure out what is efferent? Efferent is, what's another word for efferent? Motor, yeah, and afferent would be sensory. So what I'm asking is, these ascending tracts, are they sensory or motor? Afferent, yeah, because you don't do anything to make your brain move, right? So they got to be sensory tracts. So information going up to the central nervous system, these are ascending tracts, they are afferent. I don't think that's how they got that name. But descending tracts then are going to be motor or efferent tracts, right? And the same in the spinal cord. We're going to look at both of those in the spinal cord a little bit later. So those are projection fibers. There are some fibers, some tracts that carry information to one hemisphere to the other, from right to left. And that's actually kind of a really important process, because here is a big, long fissure, deep fissure that separates the cerebral hemispheres. They're not necessarily connected, well, they are not connected together on these superior parts of the hemispheres, but they are way down deep over here. So what do we call these tracts that carry information right and left? Not up and down, not from one side to another place on the same side, but from one side to the other. Those are? And we got to know the structure involved with that. It's kind of a funny word. You never use this word except in anatomy. At least I don't think so. Let me know in lab if you use this in another sense. Commissural tracts. Commissural tracts bring information from the right side to the left, or vice versa. And so here are some commissural tracts going through the corpus callosum. So the corpus callosum is the main conduit that shares information between the right and left hemispheres. And as a matter of fact, if somebody does get a stroke in this area or trauma to the corpus callosum, the right side of their brain really doesn't know what the left side is thinking, and it produces really strange kinds of behaviors and thinking patterns in people, because one hemisphere is specialized for one kind of function and the other is specialized for other kinds of things. Okay, so those are commissural. And then the third kind are what do we call the third kind? Okay, association. All right, so if one part of a cerebral hemisphere is going to share information on that same hemisphere, it will take a tract that we call an association tract. So it doesn't go up or down by general rule. It doesn't go across midline as a general rule. It stays on that same part of the central nervous system. Okay, and here we have a really nice picture that shows that. The other thing that I see, if we just look at the this is not an illustration, but this is a photograph. I can see some gray areas deep inside the cerebrum. And I see some gray areas over here deep inside the cerebrum. What is the general class of this kind of structure in the central nervous system called? By modern nomenclature, what would we want to call these deep, dark areas inside the brain? Anybody remember? Yeah, you should, I think. Because it wasn't overwritten with a test or anything. Okay? These are what we call nuclei, right? So a nucleus is a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system. And remember, nerve cell bodies are not myelinated, so they're going to look gray. So these are gray areas. Not meaning that it's not well understood, gray. It's the color gray in particular. All right? And then these nerve cell bodies send axons places, like maybe right through here. And what do you know about axons? They have a special kind of support cell that they work with, like a Schwann cell. Oh, but in the central nervous system, it is what? Oligodendrocyte. Fantastic. All right, so oligodendrocytes myelinate axons, and so when you have a group of axons going someplace in the central nervous system, we call that a tract, and it is white matter. So here I see some white matter. And between the basal nuclei and the thalamus, which is right here, this is what we call the internal capsule. So this is carrying major tracts, superiorly or inferiorly, right, so that they can pass by the basal nuclei. What is your book called, Basal Nuclei? Basal ganglia, okay, but we know now by modern nomenclature, where do we find a ganglion? Only in the peripheral nervous system, right? So this is a misnomer, but it's like your book uses it for just historical reasons, I guess. All right, so here's corpus callosum for commissural tracts, the internal capsule for projection tracts, and I don't know, I'm not going to have you know any of these association tracts between different gyri. So it goes from one gyrus to another. Not a sulcus, but between different gyri. All right, so think of all those things that we were just talking about. Nucleus, ganglia, tract. What is the counterpart of a tract in the peripheral nervous system? That is just what we call a nerve. Yeah, nerve is myelinated axons, not cell bodies and dendrites, but myelinated axons going someplace that are all grouped together. But if they're in the peripheral nervous system, they need some added protection, and that is what? The perineurium, et cetera, et cetera. We talked about that, right? Just like in skeletal muscle. All right, the cerebellum. I can see the cerebellum over here. That's not part of the brainstem, not part of the diencephalon, not part of the cerebrum. It's right here. It's posterior to the brainstem, and its major function is to maintain balance and posture. That's its big job. So in a sense, it's sort of like equilibrium so that you do not lose your balance. And it just has a bunch of little subroutines in there, like for if you want to take a drink of water and you want to reach out and get a glass. I'm sure there are programs in there that will maintain your body posture as you reach out and grab a glass. You don't lose your balance. You don't have to think about that. That's just kind of automatically taken care of, even though skeletal muscles are being used, voluntary skeletal muscles. So where could we see? Where's our exam? Yeah, it's an exam figure, but the quiz figure for next week. I can never find it. Who wrote it down? What number is that? 1-3? 14-1-3, is that what you said? 13? Oh, you got to say yell it out. 1-4, here it is. Okay, so this is a nice sagittal section of the brain. We've looked at this before because we went over the lobes of the cerebrum. And then here is the corpus callosum. And what kind of tracts do we find in the corpus callosum? Those commissural tracts, right, going from right to left. Then some other parts, we're going to look at these in lab. This right here is what we call the fornix. The fornix. And between the fornix and the corpus callosum, there's some very delicate nervous tissue that separates different chambers that we have inside the brain. And this thing right here is called the septum pellucidum. And we've learned what a septum was. What's a septum? We saw a septum in lab. What's a septum? It's like a little wall or curtain that is separating a chamber into two different places. And so there's a chamber on the right, there's a chamber on the left, and we're going to see those to be ventricles in just a second. What are some other things? Well, here is the anterior commissure. And over here is the posterior commissure. Is it labeled? Yeah, right here. Posterior commissure is labeled. What's the function of the anterior and posterior commissure? You now should be able to figure that out. What kind of tracts does it have? Commissural tracts, right? Commissural tracts. So here is another way that information can go from the left side of the central nervous system to the left or vice versa through these little tracts. All right. This thing that looks like a little walnut, I think we talked about that. Yeah, that's part of the thalamus. And I don't know, can anybody remember what the job of the thalamus? I don't remember telling you, so I got to ask to see if I told you. What's the job of the thalamus? It's a relay station. right? It gets information. It gets sensory information, which means ascending tracts go to the thalamus, and then the thalamus redirects that information to the proper location in the cerebral cortex, right? And when you have electrical activity in a certain part of the cerebral cortex, that will define what that sensation is. And we talked about the what lobes are responsible for which sensations. For instance, here's an easy one, occipital lobe. What is that responsible for? Yeah, for vision. So if electrical activity, which we call action potentials, reaches the occipital lobe, then you will have an experience of vision, no matter where those electrical signals come from, right? So where would be an appropriate place? Where would be an appropriate origin for those signals that go to the occipital lobe? How about your belly button? If your belly button sent action potentials to the occipital lobe, what would be your experience? Ah, this is strange. I guess you're finding it strange. Well, you would have an experience of vision. You would see something. And would that make sense? Absolutely not. Okay? And so what organ sends action potentials to the occipital lobe? Yeah, it would be your eyes. That's right. So eyes send information to the occipital lobe. That's partly the job of the thalamus right here. Okay. And if there was some manipulation of your belly button, for instance, I think you should know where that goes. We talked about that last time. Where is the primary somatosensory cortex? Right. There is a central sulcus that separates the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe. And what's generally the function of the frontal lobe? I said you could think of your car as an example. It's motor. So sensation from around your belly button, would it go to the frontal cortex? No, because that's motor, right? So then that sensory information would go to the parietal lobe, and in particular, the postcentral gyrus. So I'm going to review that again in just a little bit. Okay, so thalamus, hypothalamus, pituitary gland, important endocrine structure. And maybe in lab, when we were looking at foramina within the skull, if we put one of those little toothpicks or big toothpicks through the optic canal and another one through the optic canal on the other side, did those toothpicks go straight back, or what happened to them? They formed a letter. Can anybody remember what that letter was? Yeah, it formed an X, right? That's what we call the optic chiasma. So if we cut right smack in the middle of that X, it's just going to look like this little dot right here, right? So this is the optic chiasma. This is where some information from the right side of your vision goes to the left hemisphere and vice versa. Some information that you see on the left goes to the right hemisphere. So we got optic chiasma. Anterior to that, not shown on the slide, there's going to be a special part of the brain involved with smell. Does anybody know what the sense of smell is called? Yeah, olfaction. So the little olfactory bulb is going to be over in this region. We'll see that in lab, maybe in this chapter. I'm not quite sure. All right, so here is that brain stem, medulla and pons. Here's the midbrain, which is the cerebral peduncle and the corpora quadrigemina. How should you think of a peduncle? A bridge. Yeah, it's a bridge between major parts of the brain, like the brainstem and the diencephalon. Or you could say brainstem and cerebrum. That would be fine too. Okay, so that is a bunch of stuff. Okay, this blue area that we're looking at actually represents a chamber inside the brain. And these chambers are what we're going to call ventricles. The heart has chambers too, and guess what we're going to call some of those chambers in the heart? They're going to be ventricles as well. Okay. And the fluid in these ventricles is produced by some ependymal cells that have a special capillary in them, and we call that the choroid plexus. That's really important information to know, right? What produces cerebrospinal fluid? It's going to be the choroid plexus. And I can see it right here. This chamber is what we call the third ventricle. So on the roof of the third ventricle, we have choroid plexus, right, that produces CSF. Right, so we got to go back and look at number one and two, but we're going to start with number three. And then the cerebrospinal fluid moves through this little canal into this chamber, not as big as the third ventricle, but it's a chamber nonetheless. This is the fourth ventricle. It contains cerebrospinal fluid from the third, but look what else we have right in the fourth ventricle. We have additional choroid plexus that makes cerebrospinal fluid. We talked about what the function of cerebrospinal fluid was, at least the composition. Yeah, I think I talked about these chambers right here help float the brain, gives the brain some buoyancy so that it doesn't just compress all of the tissues, so the top part of the brain doesn't compress these inferior parts, right? And it helps redistribute trauma to the brain, right? And it distributes that trauma so that one region of the brain isn't damaged. So the connection between the third and fourth ventricle has got a special name, and we can see it. What part of the brain is this canal or this tunnel? What part of the brain? It's between the cerebral peduncle and the corpora quadrigemina. Corpora quadrigemina and cerebral peduncle make up the, I think it's even on this slide, makes up the, midbrain. That's right. So this canal goes through the midbrain. It's part of the midbrain, and it's called the cerebral aqueduct. Cerebral aqueduct. And it's got another name, an older name called aqueduct of Sylvius. I don't care which name you remember, probably more people, everybody's familiar with those two names. One is not more important than the other. And there's a lot of flow of cerebrospinal fluid. As a matter of fact, with the proper kind of MRI technique, you can actually watch cerebrospinal fluid come squirting out of the third ventricle into the fourth ventricle. And that's a good thing, because there should be flow between the ventricles, right? And I think it's kind of fun to think about, why does cerebrospinal fluid come squirting out of the third ventricle? Because there's no muscle in the brain. It's not like a heart, but the cerebrospinal fluid is almost acting like blood flow. It's squirting out of the brain. Could you maybe take a wild guess why that cerebrospinal fluid comes squirting out of the brain? A good hint is it does have something to do with the heart. What's the function of the heart? Haven't talked about it yet, so if you don't know, but the heart pumps blood, right? And it pumps blood all over your body, including the brain, so when the heart contracts, it pushes a whole bunch of blood up into your cerebrum, into your brain, but can your cranium expand? Can your skull expand? No, so if this big bolus of blood gets pumped up into your brain, something has to move to give way for that blood, and it is the cerebrospinal fluid. So every time the heart beats and it pushes up a bunch of blood into the cranial vault, then some of the cerebrospinal fluid then gets pumped down right into the fourth ventricle and even into this, what we call the central canal of the spinal cord. That's another pathway for cerebrospinal fluid. All right, so all of these things we'll look at in lab. We got a couple peduncles, okay? And the one that I can see very easily on this slide is what we call the cerebral peduncle. It's part of the midbrain, and here it is right here. This is on just the sagittal section. I'll try to show you on a different illustration, but in lab I'll be able to show you really nicely on real models. Right, but that's a peduncle. It's a bridge between the brainstem and higher places of the brain, okay, like the thalamus and the cerebrum. So here's the cerebral peduncle. There are peduncles that carry information from the pons into the cerebellum, but they are lateral, and we're looking here right on midline, so we can't quite see them. But I'll show you the cerebral peduncles. I think in lab we just call it a cerebral peduncle, but it's actually broken down into three. There are actually three different pieces to it, and your book does a pretty good job. I'll show you that. Okay, this pattern right here, what is this white stuff? Yeah, what is this white stuff again? I think you told me it is. Yeah, it's tracks, right? It's myelinated axons going someplace. Gray matter, what do we call this gray matter? What makes up gray matter? Cell bodies and dendrites, right? This is where all the signal processing takes place. All these cells are making a decision on what to do, and then it sends that decision out through these tracks back down to your body. Okay? And this pattern of gray matter and white matter has got a special name, and it should look like this if the cerebellum is healthy. Okay, do you see? It's labeled on this slide, right? So, and it's called arbor vitae. So arbor vitae is not like this little structure right here. It's this pattern of gray and white matter, and that just that's a pretty good sign that this cerebellum is nice and healthy, right? And arbor vitae means, does anybody know what arbor vitae means? Vitae means life, arbors, trees, so this means tree of life when you see this particular pattern. All right, so that's pretty good. Let me now show you something about the ventricles. Okay, so we started with the third, and so you're probably wondering, well, where the heck is the first and the second ventricle at? And it has actually been simplified for us because the first and second have been condensed into what we call the lateral ventricles. And the lateral ventricles are right here. So here we have an anterior view of the brain. Here's a lateral view of the brain, and you see some pretty weird structures. Let's look at this lateral view first, right? Because we've been looking at that sagittal section. Well, what did we see? We saw the third ventricle, which is right here. And then here is that interthalamic adhesion. There's no cerebrospinal fluid in this particular area because that's a bridge between the right and left lobes of the thalamus, so there can't be cerebrospinal fluid here. All right, so here is the third ventricle. What did we see on the roof of the third ventricle on the previous slide? Choroid plexus, right, making that cerebrospinal fluid. And then it's going to flow through the aqueduct of Sylvius into the fourth ventricle right there, and we also found what in the fourth ventricle? Similar to the third ventricle, more choroid plexus making cerebrospinal fluid. And from there, cerebrospinal fluid can flow into the central canal, which is in the spinal cord, or it can actually leave the fourth ventricle through some of these foramina, which we just call these apertures. Median aperture, okay, there's a lateral aperture, they had names, but you should just know that cerebrospinal fluid can come out here and then actually flow around the outside surface of the brain. We'll see where that flows in just a second. All right, so the first and second ventricle now we just call lateral ventricles. Let's look at this anterior view now. Here is the third ventricle, and is that third ventricle really thick or thin compared to the fourth? It's really thin, right? It's just kind of a sliver right through the brain. Fourth ventricle, right, is a lot bigger in left to right. There's that aqueduct once again. And then these right here are what we used to call the first and second ventricle, but now we call them the lateral ventricles because where do you find them? Do you find them on a mid-sagittal section? You do not. You have to move off midline, and hence that is lateral. So here are what we call the lateral ventricles. You will also find a choroid plexus in the lateral ventricles, and so that fluid has to be able to move into the third. It does so with this little right thing right here. Here is a hole in the septum pellucidum. This is called the interventricular foramen because it's between what? It's between the lateral ventricles and the third ventricle. And there's flow of cerebrospinal fluid from the lateral into the third ventricle. I don't think, pay attention to your study guide to see if you have to know pieces of the lateral ventricle, like the lateral horn, the posterior horn, and the inferior horn. And if we look at an anterior view once again, so here is the anterior, it curves posterior, right? And the posterior horn forms over here, and inferior is right there. I don't know if I'm going to ask you that kind of detail. Just look at the study guide. All right, so this is a pretty weird shape. You're going to be really familiar with this in lab. We have some good models and good sheep brains for us to see these various ventricles. If flow is interrupted, for instance, if there is an occlusion of the interventricular foramen, or foramina. So you see that there are two right here. The choroid plexus still produces cerebrospinal fluid, and the ventricle gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And remember, the skull can't expand, so what expands or what gets compressed as the ventricles get bigger? The brain tissue gets compressed, right? And that's a severe developmental problem. It's got a name. We call that hydrocephalus, right? So somebody's going to have severe neuronal deficits, probably won't live very long when that happens, right? With good obstetric care, then that can be diagnosed in utero, and even recently, right, that Freiman can be operated on surgically even before a baby is born, which is pretty cool. So a tube can be placed in one of these ventricles, and then it can be placed in a vein so that that cerebrospinal fluid, right, goes into your circulatory system instead of compressing the brain. And you have a figure of somebody with hydrocephalus right here. Okay. So you can see that the ventricles are compressing the brain. The skull is trying to accommodate, but it certainly can't do that. Here is an example of what a choroid plexus is. Remember, here are the ependymal cells that line every ventricle. Here is a capillary that comes down and forms the choroid plexus with these ependymal cells. And the ependymal cells then maintain cerebrospinal fluid so that it has glucose. That's an important energy molecule. Brain cells can use glucose. It has oxygen, vitamins, and ions. Here are some ions. We talked about sodium. That's an important electrolyte. Here are two that we haven't mentioned yet. Probably not too important in this class, but eventually you're going to see they're very important. And that is the chloride ion and magnesium. Mg stands for magnesium. And why do we call these things electrolytes? Because they have electrical charge on them, right? So, again, we're very electrical beings because of all of these electrolytes in our body. They have to have the proper concentrations. All right, before we leave, I want to show you this right here. All right, so the septum pellucidum has been taken away so that we can look into the lateral ventricle right here. Right, so let's just pretend that we're looking right underneath the corpus callosum into a lateral ventricle. Here's the third. Ooh, what ventricle is this over here? That's the fourth. The connection between the lateral and the third is called the interventricular foramen. And what's the function of a foramen? Passageway for something, blood vessel, nerve. In this particular case, it's going to be cerebrospinal fluid. Right. And here's a central canal in the spinal cord. So cerebrospinal fluid flows from the lateral into the third, where it joins some other cerebrospinal fluid that's produced in the third ventricle, and then that flows down this cerebral aqueduct into the fourth. It can leave the fourth ventricle and go into this space on the exterior part of the brain, or it can go down through the central canal all the way down to the bottom of the spinal cord, and then it rejoins this cerebrospinal fluid on the exterior part of the brain. Right, so descending cerebrospinal fluid in the central canal, ascending in the space between the central nervous system and some connective tissue layers, and then it then goes all the way to the top of the head, right here. Can you see all these arrows? Moving cerebrospinal fluid to the top of the head, and then that cerebrospinal fluid gets resorbed by the circulatory system. This special area right here is called an arachnoid villus, or arachnoid granulation. This allows cerebrospinal fluid to escape, right, and enter the circulatory system. And this right here is what we call the superior sagittal sinus. We'll look at it, I think, when we get to the cardiovascular system. And this particular sinus contains blood, venous blood, not arterial blood, but venous blood, and it eventually then will drain back to the jugular vein. Jugular vein will drain blood back to the heart. That's a short form of that circuit. We'll learn some more things about it. So here is an important flow pattern of cerebrospinal fluid that you should be aware of. Okay, so where does the cerebrospinal fluid flow? It flows through one of these different layers, so guess what that means. We got to know something about those layers. And those of you that looked at your study guide, you're maybe familiar with this picture already. Here is a nice cross-section, transverse section, and we can see maybe parietal bone here or frontal bone. I can't quite tell what it is. Right? It's not really labeled on this slide, but probably not too important. Right? So here's a bone. You can tell it's a flat bone. Right? And then here is the membrane on the outside of a bone. What do we call that membrane on the outside? The periosteum, and then on top of the periosteum you have skin of the scalp. All right, so here is the skull. So now we're getting inside the skull. We got three main connective tissue layers. These two actually form one layer. This is what we call the dura mater. Oh, and I see it over here, dura mater. And dura just means very durable and tough. And mater means matter. This is the toughest, the thickest kind of membrane that surrounds the brain. And it's actually harder than leather. It's actually very, very stiff. It protects the brain very nice, even though it's thin. If we have to deal with that in lab when we do our brain dissections, you'll see that it's really a pain to deal with it because it's so hard, it's hard to cut through. And when we try to remove it to see the brain, the brain just kind of rips apart. So you got to be really careful when we take the dura mater off of a brain when we do a dissection. Dura mater has got two divisions or two subdivisions. The periosteal is the division that's right up against the, what do you know about osteal bone? Yeah, so that's part of the dura mater that's up against the flat bones of the skull, right? And then the meningeal layer is deep. So what we're looking at collectively are what we call the meninges. Meninges has these three different layers. The most superficial is the dura mater. The next layer that I see right here is a whole lot thinner. This is the arachnoid. And then there's a third layer, which we can just barely see, but I think you can appreciate it if we talk about it. Right, it's right on the surface of the brain. And everywhere where there is a sulcus, remember, a depression in the surface of the brain is a sulcus, that pia mater follows right down into the sulcus and it comes back up. So every little layer, right, or every little surface of the cerebrum is covered with the pia mater. Pia mater is connected to the arachnoid, right, by these connective tissue fibers here, but there, so that forms a big space. There's a big space between the arachnoid and the pia, and the space is underneath the arachnoid, so sometimes we call this the subarachnoid space. And this is where we find cerebral spinal fluid coming back to be reabsorbed by blood that's in the superior sagittal sinus. So outside of the brain, cerebral spinal fluid moves around through the subarachnoid space. That's a good space to remember. And since it surrounds the whole central nervous system, you'll find this also in the spinal cord as well. Okay. So I think that describes everything. The other interesting thing, of course, you can see gray matter and white matter. Gray matter is superficial. And do we see any big blood vessels in white matter or gray matter of the brain? Where do we find blood vessels? You should be able to tell me exactly where they're located. They're in the subarachnoid space, right? So that's clearly illustrated right here, both veins and arteries. And then here's a big, super big vein. This is what we call the superior sagittal sinus, which receives cerebral spinal fluid after it goes through that circulatory pattern that we just looked at on the previous slide. All right, so this is really important because when somebody has head trauma, we're interested in all of these layers right here, very interested, right, to see where swelling is. So if there is swelling in a subarachnoid space right here, it's going to compress the brain and kill that part of the brain. And so that swelling has to be relieved, reduced by aspiration, right? So a little hole is placed and then that fluid is drained out. Okay, so that's pretty good for the brain. And we got to finish up with spinal cord, because spinal cord is part of the central nervous system. Okay. So, spinal cord, Okay, so we looked at this before. So here is the spinal cord in its entirety, starting at the foramen magnum, going all the way down, not to the coccyx, not to the sacrum, but it stops right here. This is about at the level of L2. What does L2 mean? Yeah, lumbar, right? And that, so that's the extent, because we grow faster in height, faster than the spinal cord can grow. It can't keep up with this, right? So it stops growing, but then it sends nerves down through the vertebral canal to exit these other parts within the vertebral column and the sacrum. And so where all these nerve fibers are located, this is what we call the cauda equina. So does anybody have an idea what equina means? How about equestrian? That is having to do with horses. And cauda means tail. So that reminded somebody of a horse's tail with all the little hair fibers coming, making up a tail. So from L2 down to wherever it's going to exit the vertebral canal or sacral canal, right, that's the cauda equina. The very end of the spinal cord, it has a pointed end to it. That's what we call the conus medullaris. Conus just means that it's shaped like a cone, right? And it's deep inside the vertebral column. The other thing that's important that I see, this very center part that runs through the cauda equina, we call that the phylum terminale, and it is some connective tissue that puts some traction on the conus medullaris. It attaches it to the sacrum, right? And if that was not there, then the spinal cord would have a tendency to retract back up to the brain, right? And it would damage all of these nerves coming out of the spinal cord. And of course, that would be very damaging. So that has to be in place to keep the spinal cord in its right location. But there's another kind of pathological situation that is just as bad, and that is if the conus medullaris, right, is attached to where the phylum terminale is during development, right? The phylum terminale doesn't develop just right, but the conus medullaris is attached way down here at the sacrum. Can you imagine what happens to the spinal cord as somebody is developing? It gets stretched, right? It doesn't quite snap, but it really stretches out of shape, and that produces severe neuronal deficits as well. That is what we call a tethered cord. Maybe you heard of tethered cord, and that cord refers to what? The phylum terminale, tethered cord. And tethered just means tied to. So all of these things can happen. We have some enlargements of the spinal cord in the cervical region and lumbar region, not in the thoracic region, because in the thoracic region, what don't you have? That's too bad, but we don't have any appendages. We don't have any arms or legs in that region, right? So the spinal cord doesn't have to be as big. There aren't many nerves leaving the spinal cord. And even more importantly, there aren't special kinds of reflexes that happen in the thorax. Like, for instance, that could happen here in the brachial region. For instance, if you reach out and grab something on the stove and you think it's cold, but it's burning hot, guess what your hand is going to do? It's going to drop it, and you know what? All those signals for dropping that pan originate from the spinal cord. You can't appreciate what's happening in your spinal cord, so that is what we call a reflex. You drop that pan before you even know your hand is being burned, right? So there needs to be extra nerves within the spinal cord to accommodate all those different kinds of reflexes. And we have those reflexes both in the upper and lower appendage. All right, let's look at a cross-section of spinal cord. And this is a pretty good cross-section right here. Right, we see a nice lumbar vertebrae. And, oh, could anybody tell me what level are we looking at right here? And you can tell by looking at the vertebrae, because I see what? Transverse foramina, bifid spinous process. Right, you don't have to tell me which number, but here is the spinal cord, and in the spinal cord you can see white matter and gray matter, right? And in this particular case, is gray matter deep or superficial? Remember, in the cerebellum and cerebrum, where do we find gray matter? Superficial? What's a superficial part of any organ? That's called the cortex, right? Like the cerebral cortex has gray matter. Now contrast that with the spinal cord. Where do we find gray matter? It is deep, right? And white matter, right, is in the cortex, is superficial. And I think it's important to know what is in all of this white matter of the spinal cord. It's central nervous system. What is white matter in the central nervous system called? Tracts. That's right, tracts. So there are myelinated axons bringing information up to the brain or taking information down from the brain to the periphery. So there are what? Motor and sensory tracts in the spinal cord, or afferent or efferent tracts. And then in the gray matter, what do we have? We have dendrites and cell bodies. Right, so the job of these tracts over here is to carry information superiorly or inferiorly, but the job of the gray matter is to make connections between different neurons and different kinds of tracts. This is where reflexes are determined, like when we said when you drop something that's really hot, right? That processing power comes from the gray matter of the spinal cord, just like processing power in the cerebrum is gray matter, but it's in the cortex in that particular case. Here I see that nice central canal. What's in the central canal of the spinal cord? Cerebrospinal fluid, right? From the fourth ventricle, it flows down. And then it flows back up through the subarachnoid space. Here's that nice arachnoid membrane. Here's the subarachnoid space. Then CSF, cerebrospinal fluid, flows back up to the brain and then resorbed through those arachnoid granulations. Okay, so you have this three layers of the meninges in the spinal cord, but you have another space that is on top of the dura mater or superficial to the dura mater, and I can see that there's some adipose tissue in this region right here, very close to the spinal cord. Certainly it's within the vertebral canal. This is kind of an important space because what can be introduced into this epidural space for somebody when they need something? Okay, yeah, anesthetic, right, can be injected into the space, and that anesthetic will poison the nerve impulses or the axons in this region right here so that sensory information can't get through this part of the spinal cord. Certainly we would, you know, that to be called an epidural, right, which is a special localized form of anesthesia. And that is really nice because anesthesia can be really difficult, can be difficult to overcome, right? If somebody is under anesthesia for a long period of time, they might feel the effects for months, maybe even a year under certain circumstances. So if somebody doesn't have to undergo general anesthesia, but just have some local anesthesia, of course, that's much better for everybody, right? And it's usually given, right, for somebody that is delivering. So if you give general anesthesia to a mom who's delivering, who else gets that general anesthesia? The baby. Ooh, that's bad. Okay, but a local baby doesn't feel that anesthesia in this location here, right? So that is the particular beauty of that, because it's really hard to monitor fetal signs in utero, like blood pressure, things like that. So general anesthesia is not good for a fetus. Okay, here's that spinal cord, right? Gray matter, white matter. Here is a pathway that is attaching to the spinal cord, and there are tracts in this region right here. So we're going to call this a nerve because it has left the spinal cord, and I see one down over here as well. These nerves that enter or leave are what we call roots. Right, so these are roots, and there are two roots on either side of the spinal cord, and these are really particular. Roots carry information only in one direction. All right, so remember, this is dorsal or posterior. So here is the dorsal root. The dorsal root is responsible for bringing information into the central nervous system. So what is its function if it brings information in? You could tell me two different ways. And you got to tell me in two different ways before we move on. It is, I heard afferent over here, and I heard sensory over here, and that's exactly right. All right, so the dorsal root is for sensory information. And it's moving into the CNS, right? And that's it. No motor signals are passed through the dorsal root. Motor signals leave the spinal cord through the ventral root. No one ever calls it anterior, but probably people would know what you're talking about. So here's the ventral root, here's the dorsal root, and the dorsal root is also going to be 100% either motor or sensory, and you could probably guess which one it is. It is motor. All right, so the ventral root is 100% motor, and the dorsal root is 100% sensory. And the nerves, the type of nerves that we have in the dorsal root right here are unipolar neurons. I don't know if you can remember what a unipolar looks like, but there's a cell body, and then there's our long projections that come off, and they go in two different directions, right? And the cell body is located in this dorsal root ganglion. What's a ganglion once again? It's a group of nerve cell bodies located where? In the peripheral nervous system, right? So here's a group of nerve cell bodies in peripheral nervous system, therefore this has to be a ganglion, and it's in the dorsal root, so this is where the cell bodies of those unipolar neurons are. They send signals, or they send a process down this way that receives signals. That would be the peripheral process of that unipolar cell, and then here would be the central process of that process going into the central nervous system. That's why we call that the central process, right? That's why we call this the peripheral process over here. It's because of the parts of the nervous system that it is receiving and sending information to. All right, there's no ganglion in this motor root. The nerve cell bodies are, oh, you could take a guess. Where do we find nerve cell bodies that send axons into this ventral root? Yeah, they're in this gray matter right here, right? And the gray matter has different areas we're going to look at. Right, and we call them horns, for instance. So here is the anterior horn, here's the posterior horn, here's a lateral horn, and only certain parts of the spinal cord have these lateral horns, and maybe next week we can talk about why certain parts of the spinal cord have these lateral horns. But nonetheless, these motor neurons, right, have cell bodies in the gray matter, they send axons out, and when it's time to leave the vertebral column, they leave via this ventral root. Can anybody remember what the shape of a motor neuron is? It's a nice multipolar neuron, right? So there's going to be a cell body with a whole bunch of very short dendrites and one really long axon, and if it's going to a skeletal muscle, it's going to go all the way to that skeletal muscle from the spinal cord, right, all the way to that skeletal muscle. So these things are really long, but they're still microscopically thin. If we look over here, and now we're still in the peripheral nervous system, the dorsal root and ventral root join together as they leave the vertebral column. This right here now is really what we call a nerve. Right? And where do we find nerves? Do we find nerves in the central nervous system? No. What do we find in the CNS? Tracts. Yeah, we find tracts. Right? But here is a nerve. It has myelinated axons. There's no cell bodies here. And the function of this nerve, take a guess at what the function of this spinal nerve is. It has components of the dorsal root and ventral root combined. So the function of the spinal nerve is both motor and sensory. If something has both motor and sensory components, we say it is mixed. So the function of this spinal nerve right here is mixed. And even after this bifurcation, I think we're going to talk about this, where would you find the vertebral column in your body? Is it like right smack in the middle, or is it more anterior or more posterior? Yeah, I think you can picture, right, the skeleton in the lab is mostly posterior. So where do you have most of your body? In front of the vertebral column or behind? Mostly anterior to the vertebral column, right? So you need a lot of nerve fibers going to that part of the body because there's just a lot more there. And we can see a very large nerve that's going to move anteriorly and then a kind of thin one moving posteriorly. These are what we call rami. Here is the ventral ramus, and here is the posterior ramus. So posterior takes information to tissue posterior to the vertebral column, and the anterior ramus takes information to everything in front of the vertebral column, and that's why they have different shapes. So let's take a look and see what we have. So we got gray matter, white matter, And then we have these two things, which are roots. And then we have roots joining together to form the spinal nerve, because we call that a spinal nerve because it's leaving the spinal cord. And then that spinal nerve bifurcates into two different rami, yeah. The dorsal ramus or the ventral ramus. All right, those are really good things for you to know for both lecture and for lab. Okay, we got some more really good pictures of the spinal cord. Just a little bit different perspective, right? You can see the three layers of the meninges, dermator, arachnoid, and then a space between the arachnoid and the pia, right? That's the subarachnoid space. And that's kind of a special space because, what does it contain? Yeah, cerebrospinal fluid. And cerebrospinal fluid. Here is the ventral root. Don't forget, that's 100% motor. Here is the dorsal root. And these little tiny fibers coming out of the spinal cord that join together to form a root, these are what we call rootlets. And rootlets are either sensory or motor as well, depending on where they are located. Okay, what is this bulge right there? Yeah, it's a ganglion. And for what purpose, motor or sensory? Sensory, because it's part of the dorsal root, right? Okay, and then here's that spinal nerve. Here's the dorsal and ventral ramus. And I see two of these other little things branching off. We're going to look at those in a couple chapters. We're going to come back to these in a little bit because it has something to do with the real special nervous system that we have. All right, so here we see some other, the whole part of the spinal cord. The white matter is broken up into these three areas, the dorsal, right, the lateral, and the ventral. Sometimes it's called the funiculus. Okay, it's got another name, columns, right? Dorsal columns, ventral columns, you could call them either one that you wish. The gray matter has these horns that we were talking about, right, like the lateral, ventral, posterior horns. But there's also some commissural intersections here between these horns, and that's called the gray commissure. All right, so this is a way that information can go from one side of the spinal cord to the other. So for instance, if you grab that hot pan once again with your right hand, what is your right hand going to do? It's going to drop it and you're going to pull it away. But there's something your left hand might do. Guess what your left hand might do? It might grab something and push. So when you grab something that's damaging your body with your right hand will go one way and your left hand will go the other, which means information has to go from the right side of the body to the left. And how does it get from the right side of the body to the left at the level of a spinal cord? It is through the gray commissure, because you know commissure is responsible for sharing information right to left in the central nervous system. All right, so this is an exam figure because it shows all of these really nice layers, right? The dorsal root, ventral root. You know, every once in a while, I remember something with a really silly method. And I mentioned some of these in lab, like this semimembranosis. Did I tell anybody how I remember semimembranosis in lab? There's one group that hasn't had lab yet, but three have. Because the membranosus muscle is medial, and there's a lot of M's in membranosus, and there's a nice big M in medial, so even if I have a really nice long summer break, when I come back in the fall, I can still kind of pull that information out and remember, right? It's a little trick. All right, so there's a similar kind of really silly trick to remember that the dorsal root is sensory and the ventral root is motor, based on those consonants, right? Because there's a nice S in dorsal, right, and S in sensory, right? There's a T in ventral and a T in motor as well. So that's, if you have a hard time remembering that, just kind of, maybe if you just think of that little trick, okay, maybe it will just pop into your mind really fast. Okay, so that's another level of the spinal cord. Let's see what other kinds of things. Oh, yeah. Okay, let's look at this one. I don't want to go into too much complexity here, but just a little bit. All right, so what did we say the function of this dorsal root is? Sensory, okay? And that is, dorsal is the same thing as posterior, right? And what about this ventral root? Motor, right there. All right, well, the architecture of the central nervous system is maintained to some degree, to a large degree, between the brain and the spinal cord. So let's look at the spinal cord, and we know the ventral root is motor, but now let's think about the brain. What part of the brain is motor, generally speaking? It is the frontal lobe, right? The anterior lobe within the brain. And where is sensory? Occipital lobe, parietal lobe, temporal lobe, which is posterior. And can you see that the architecture of the spinal cord follows that same arrangement? Anteriorly, okay, is motor. Posteriorly is mostly sensory. So there are going to be tracts. Tracts in the ventral region here are descending. And tracts that are in the dorsal region here are ascending because they're going to more central, no, to more posterior parts of the brain. That's just kind of a general rule. There are all kinds of tracts. I'm going to have you know just a couple of them, but you're going to mostly find that motor is ventral and sensory tracts or afferent tracts or ascending tracts are going to be dorsal. All right, so this is a pretty good slide just so you can see all the roots. What kind of neuron do you see right here? What is that? That's a nice unipolar neuron, right? Here's a cell body. Here is one process. Here's the other process. Could you name this process right here of this nice boat? It's a unipolar. Yeah. What's this process right here? That's the peripheral process going out to the periphery. And then here is the central process because it's going into the spinal cord. All right, so make sure you know this is a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar. I maybe said bipolar just a second ago. I can't remember, but don't say bipolar, right, because it's a unipolar. Okay, so roots are either motor or sensory, but what about a nerve out over here? It is, what do we call that? It is mixed. Yeah, it is mixed. Okay. And even the rami are mixed, and I don't see any the ventral and dorsal ramus, but those are mixed because they're nerves as well. Okay, let's see what other things I should mention in class. Okay, just a couple tracts. We have two tracts. Spinal thalamic tract. I'm not going to show you a slide just yet. Okay, spinal thalamic tract and cortical spinal tract. Two different kinds of tracts right here. All right, so let's stop thinking about nerves. Let's think about a muscle. And generally, a muscle has two ends. And is it important to know what those two ends do, and do they have different meanings, two different names? Yeah. What's one end of a muscle called? Origin. Is the origin, and the other end is the insertion. And does that have a special meaning, or can we just mix it up all over the place? Special meaning, which means origin is? Stationary end, insertion is the more movable end, right? And a lot of muscles are named by their origin and insertion, which makes them really easy to know where they're located, right, and what their action is. And probably one of your favorite might be sternocleidomastoid, okay, because the origin and insertion is in part of that name, even though it seems really intimidating. Like the what part of the word is the origin, the first part or the last part? First part. And the insertion is the last part, okay? Same thing for tracts. The tracts are named after where they originate and where they end up, where they terminate. And the origin is listed first, and the termination is listed second within that word. All right, so spinal thalamic tract, where does it start? In the spine, and where does it end up? In the thalamus. So that's pretty easy to know. Spinal thalamic tract, all right, is between the spinal cord and thalamus. So is that an efferent or afferent tract? You know that information too, just by the name. If it starts in the spine and ends in the thalamus, could it be motor? Afferent. No, because it's going the wrong way. Right, so that's a sensory tract, or you could say afferent tract, doesn't really matter. Now what about the cortical spinal tract? What's the function of that one? Is it easy to tell? Yes, because it starts in the cortex, cerebral cortex is what that means, and it ends up in the spinal cord. So that's a descending tract, and you know descending tracts to be efferent or motor. Right? So just by knowing these names. Okay, spinal thalamic tract has, oh, what is that? That's an ascending tract, sensory. It has three neurons, a first, second, and third order. Let's see if we can take a look where that is. All right, tracts. In particular, spinal thalamic. Okay, here it is. This is an exam figure. And here we have a nice unipolar neuron. Here's the peripheral process. There are receptors right on the dendrites here of that peripheral process. Could be pain or temperature, right? And here I see a little match, so that could be temperature or pain. They're receptors. That's going to send action potentials toward the central nervous system. So this is a nice afferent nerve, right? And it's a unipolar neuron. Here's that cell body in the dorsal root ganglia. Enters via the dorsal root into the spinal cord, and there it stops. See, should I zoom in? Gosh, I'm going to lose my arrow, but I want to zoom in. Oh, yeah, that's much better. Okay, so here is the first neuron. The first order neuron brings information into the spinal cord. And then here's a synapse. We've talked about a synapse before. So there's a neurotransmitter secreted by the first order that excites the second order. The second order neuron, okay, then sends an axon to the opposite side of the spinal cord, and then it arises through a tract or a column. Okay, we call that a funiculus and a column are the same thing. Funiculus and column. Right? So then it goes up to the brain, so it's still the second order neuron going all the way up. And let's zoom back out. Can I grab it? Nope. And it goes all the way. Where does the spinal thalamic tract go to? Goes to the thalamus. Here's the thalamus. And what's the job of the thalamus once again? Relay station. So here's the third order neuron that's going to take that sensory information to the proper part of the cerebral cortex where you have the appreciation of whatever modality that was, right? Whether it was a pin sticking you or fire, right? Vibration or whatever. And then you have that perception on the cerebral cortex because that's where the gray matter is. So did you see the first, second, and third order? Third order takes information from the thalamus to the cerebral cortex. And in particular, the primary somatosensory cortex. Right? And what lobe of the brain is the primary somatosensory cortex? You got two choices, frontal or parietal. And we know frontal to be motor, and this is not motor, this is sensory, so this is in the parietal lobe, okay, right posterior to the central sulcus. Oh, what's a sulcus once again? It's a depression in the brain. I did point that out to you. Maybe I'll point it out to you once again. If we look at this particular slide here, here's that central sulcus, right? Here's the precentral for motor, somatomotor, which means what? Voluntary control. Here is the postcentral gyrus. This is for sensation on the surface of your body. Now, there's something pretty interesting and strange about this. The layout of the precentral and postcentral gyrus. It's laid out pretty much in a diagram of a person, of a human being. Let's see if I can find that. And that little person is what we call a homunculus. Here it is right here. Can you see a little person right there? I see two little people. All right. I see a tongue. I see a face. And then I see a hand. I see an arm, a trunk, right? That leg and some toes. All right. And remember, the surface area of the cortex has to do with processing power or sensory power, okay, or sensory ability. So if we look at this little homunculus, this little man right here, where would we find most of our senses for perception? Would it be in our toes or foot? buttocks, arm, where do we have a lot of sensation, very good discrimination? Yeah, it's in the hand and fingers. Oh, and look at that thumb, right? So we have a lot of receptors in this region, so we need a large surface area on the brain to process that information. Same thing for the face. Okay, the face, is, the head is very large as well. Okay, so that's the homunculus. And if we look at on the other side over here, okay, this is not the right and left side of the cerebrum. This is anterior and posterior. So here is that homunculus. Pretty much the right and left look the same. But let's look and see where it's coming from. All right, so here is the whole brain. Here's posterior, here's anterior. This plane right here is placed in the central sulcus. So the precentral sulcus is colored in a nice red color, and the postcentral is in a nice blue color. Right? And so what does the red represent? Sensory or motor? It's going to be motor. So this is motor over here. And the blue, since it's in the postcentral gyrus, it is sensory, right? So here is the postcentral gyrus, and it is colored in blue. So if I were to stimulate, what should we do? If I were to stimulate, right, this part of the brain right here, would something move or would you sense something? You would sense something because this is what, the sensory cortex, and where would you feel that sensation? On your foot someplace, right? Maybe on the sole of your foot. What would you call that? Tickling, okay? All right, so you would feel that, right? Take that same stimulus, right, and not place it on the foot, but let's place it over here on the forehead. You'd still feel that same sensation, but localized to a different part of your body, right? And so if somebody has a stroke and this part of your brain dies as a result, what's going to happen? Will you have a sensory deficit or a motor deficit? Sensory, and where won't you be able to sense things? In the region of the head, in particular the forehead right here. Okay? And what gyrus is this? This is for sensation. The post-central gyrus, right? Because parietal lobe is sensation. And what is the motor gyrus for the primary somatomotor cortex? What gyrus is that? Anterior to the central sulcus, and here it is right here. So if we stimulate this part of the brain, I tell you what, this part of the brain right here, what's going to happen? Are you going to feel something or is something going to move? Something is going to move, right? And what's going to move? Maybe orbicularis oculi might move. Or if we stimulate this area right here, something's going to move, which would be what? Maybe the orbicularis oris. Right? And so if somebody has a stroke in this region of the brain, what will be the deficit? A sensory deficit or motor deficit? Yeah, not over here, but just right here. Motor deficit, and what won't a person be able to move as a result of that? Their hand, right? And if it's this whole area here, then it is hand and arm as well. Okay, so this, the surface of the brain maps out very nicely to the surface on your body or position in your body, and we call this the little homuncular person, homunculus, both sensory and motor. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign that sign-in sheet. And we're mostly done with central nervous system, or a quick view of the central nervous system. See you. Hi. So is this stuff fun, central nervous fun, or is it like really scary, intimidating?
Scary.
Scary, huh? Not too scary? Okay. Spend some time with it. You'll love it.